name is Michael McCusker. All opinions on this program are mine and mine only in the entire universe, but I hope not. It is a cold, sleety, rainy morning today on the mid-Oregon coast. A perfect day to think about the tremendous forest fires that have recently conflagrated Southern California. I wish to historically commemorate one of the worst conflagrations recorded, the Tillamook burn of nearly a century ago, or more accurately, the Tillamook burns of the 1930s. And I quote two eternally famous Oregon writers, Ellis Lucia and Stuart Holbrook. 91 years ago, the first Tillamook burn started on August 14, 1933, and decimated a magnificant 400-year-old forest that had been the heart and soul of Oregon's coastal mountain range. It was one of the wildest and devastating fires ever recorded. In human reckoning, more than 13 million board feet of timber, worth $275 million in 1933, was destroyed. Total acreage consumed by the fire was 411,000 acres, or more than 600 square miles of dead forest. And it was a zoological holocaust. Animals, fish, and birds perished in unbeknown immolation. The fire was actually several fires, spawned by each other, and they burned over a distance from near Mount Hebo in the south to Seaside, and from Forest Grove almost to Wheeler, east to west. The fires burned unrestrained for 2 weeks. Only one human being was killed, a young firefighter from the Depression era Civilian Conservation Corps. Thousands were forced to flee. In one period of 20 hours, the fire was so intense that it burned 240,000 acres, generating hurricane velocity winds that propelled it into an immense firestorm. A famous photograph shows a monstrous black explosion hurtling above a burning mountain. Oregon writer Ellis Lucia wrote in his 1984 book, Tillamook Burn Country, on the memorable day of August 24th, the Tillamook fire literally exploded, becoming a rampaging giant that nothing could stop, traveling at high speed and destroying all in its path, its mushroom cloud boiling more than 40,000 feet into the atmosphere, visible for hundreds of miles at sea and inland. Ash fell on ships, Lucia wrote, and likened the firestorm to, quote, an atomic bomb of a decade later, unquote. One of Oregon's most notable writers, Lucia, also compared the huge cloud of smoke to the 1980 volcanic eruption of Mount St. Helens. He wrote that the fire, quote, mounted into an awesome wall of flame, exploding again and again in the tops of 400-year-old giants and creating an inferno unlike anything since the ancient eruptions of the Pacific Northwest's volcanic peaks. And he wrote that 3,000 firefighters were helpless as the gigantic mushroom cloud spiraled into the sky and blotted out the sun. When the 1933 fire finally burned itself out, quote, Oregonians looked in horror and disbelief at the destruction. Much was unrecognizable. Even familiar landmarks were completely gone. In the fire's aftermath, a new American desert was created, Lucia wrote, stretching in all directions to the far horizons, quote unquote. He wrote that driving through the burn was like driving through a forest of the dead. After a few years, black snags were bleached white by the summer sun, and were a familiar sight to Oregonians, and that was Lucia. 6 years later, in August 1939, a fire almost the equal of its predecessor swept back over the burn and beyond, which took 4,000 firefighters more than a month to bring under control. The 1939 Holocaust mushroomed into the atmosphere much as the same as 1933, Lucia wrote. The flames moved in all directions, again threatening Tillamook and smaller communities. Ash, sparks, and debris fell on northern coastal beaches. After 4 weeks, the rains came, and that was Lucia. A major tragedy of the 1930 fire, quote, was that it burned into green timber, which might have seeded denuded slopes to become a new forest, unquote, Ella Lucia wrote. This wiped out any hope of natural reseeding. Lucia wrote that by the time the Tillamook burn exploded a third time in the hot summer of 1945, Oregonians were convinced that the tragic region was under a six-year jinx. And it did burn one more time in 1951, which lasted 4 days and burned 20,000 acres, and it killed a firefighter. Lucia wrote that because of the continuing fires, quote, nature never had a chance to make a comeback. Each new fire reburned the wasteland, that the Tillamook burn would never come back, at least for generations, seemed a strong possibility. For years afterward, the timber companies that were held primarily responsible for starting the fires mined the burnt dead snags in the same manner as would be done around Mount St. Helens after its May 18, 1980 eruption knocked down millions of trees. Another great Oregon writer, Stuart H. Holbrook, who had been a logger in his youth, wrote that, quote, long trains loaded with coal-black logs were rolling down off the hills, unquote, after the four fires. Reforestation of the Tillamook burn was delayed until the late 1940s, when most of the snags from the devastating succession of fires were logged. Thousands of volunteers and school children worked for years to replant the forest. Year after year, the planting crews moved out along the rugged slopes of the burn, often in snow and frigid temperatures, for winter was the best time for planting, Ellis Lucia wrote. It was inglorious work all through the 1950s and turbulent 60s, big city riots, the Vietnam War, and into the 70s. In all, Lucia wrote, 73 million seedlings were planted on 76,234 acres. Countless thousands of trees were planted by the youngsters who came from around the state. They felt very strongly about reforesting the giant burn. To be sure, he wrote, the student expeditions never got into the deep backcountry. That was left to the professionals and the helicopters. But who would ever say that youth did not replant the Tillamook burn? The main reseeding and replanting was essentially completed in 1973-74, but it was still being done when Ellis Lucia wrote his book, Tillamook Burn Country, in 1984. And of course, the timber companies and gypo loggers are back logging the burn. Like the fires they carelessly started, there is not much in their path to stop them. The sweet smell of jobs is the scent they wear in hearings and negotiations. And as an epilogue, the word firestorm, which is currently used to describe the immense forest and wildland fires of the past several years of depictable and increasingly intense global warming, was first used to express the catastrophic firebombing of German cities in World War II, in particular Hamburg in 1943 and Dresden in 1945, and the extensive immolation of Japanese cities in that same war just prior to the use of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945. And that was something I wrote. And now, by Carlos Lozada. Born in the USA does not mean what it used to. And he wrote this for the New York Times. Consider the idea of a birthright. Historically, it has been an exclusionary concept, a title, nobility passed on to the firstborn male, an inheritance of wealth and status, a claim to land that must remain within a family or a clan. A birthright, by definition, belongs to one person at the expense of someone else. It is not shared. It is mine, quote, not ours, quote. America's tradition of birthright citizenship, specified in the Constitution's 14th Amendment, passed and ratified after the Civil War, upends that understanding. The American birthright is encompassing rather than exclusionary. It is by definition for all. Though the United States is hardly the only country to grant citizenship to those born within its borders, the practice has become an essential trait of our national character. The old notion of birthright reinforces class division, even class oppression. America's birthright, in contrast, is a source of equality before the law, a starting point for the pursuit of happiness. The 14th Amendment's citizenship clause is not just in the Constitution. It identifies the source of the document's enduring legitimacy. If the Constitution was ordained and established by, quote, we the people, unquote, then it helps to know who counts among the people who is included in that we. During its first days, the Trump administration announced several orders and policies that would radically transform America's posture toward immigration, blocking asylum seekers at the southern border, deploying the U.S. military to help seal that border, cracking down on undocumented immigrants already in the country, and suspending the entry of refugees from around the world, as well as rejecting the principle of birthright citizenship. This last effort, in particular, seems unlikely to survive judicial scrutiny. More than 20 states have immediately challenged the citizenship order, and a federal judge in Seattle has temporarily blocked it, calling it, quote, blatantly unconstitutional, unquote. Yet it is that very unlikelihood that renders the administration's action especially noteworthy. In trying to unmake this American birthright, President Donald Trump is doing much more than taking control of the border or creating a disincentive for future immigrants to the United States. He is seeking to limit and redefine that we, quote unquote, that makes up America. He does not have to win this battle right away, though I'm sure he'd like to. By questioning birthright citizenship at all, he aims to erode its legitimacy. By tossing it into the political and judicial fray, he succeeds in having the American birthright bruised and weakened. The text of the executive order is impressive in its sleight of hand. The title, Protecting the Meaning and Value of American Citizenship, is the precise opposite of what the document seeks to accomplish. Trump's order does not protect the meaning of citizenship, but threatens it. His order does not enhance the value of citizenship, but cheapens it by making it conditional rather than universal. The order calls U.S. citizenship a priceless and profound gift. It is indeed priceless and profound, but describing it as a gift gives the game away. After all, the recipient of a gift has no prior right to it, no claim to uphold. The gift is bestowed at the whim of the giver. Quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, unquote. The 14th Amendment begins, quote, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside, unquote. Immigrants to this country can strive to become U.S. citizens, establishing residence, filling out forms, passing tests, swearing oaths, but their native-born children gain that status automatically. Quote, persons born, unquote, here need not swear an oath. Their citizenship is instantly conveyed, their allegiance automatically assumed. It need not be earned or remanded, and it is not doled out selectively through the benevolence of a fickle leader. It simply is. The first words of constitutional clauses are telling. That we, that leads off the preamble, is inspirational, an imagined community as much as a real one. The Constitution opens by speaking on behalf of a united people, when, in fact, the unification of that people is among its foremost goals. Yuval Levine writes in his recent book, American Covenant. No coincidence, the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence begins with the same first-person plural form. We hold these truths to be self-evident, it reads, even at the fact that those self-evident truths were far from self-fulfilling, limited to a narrow interpretation of we. The 14th Amendment, our longest single tweak to the Constitution, affirmed due process law and equal protection of the laws as fundamental concepts. Yet birthright citizenship retains pride of place at the beginning of the amendment's text. Quote, all persons born or naturalized, unquote. The amendment's citizenship clause was aimed primarily at redressing the ills of black enslavement and clarifying the status of the nation's newly emancipated people. But, as Eric Foner writes in his 2019 book, The Second Founding, it would grow to include much more than even that. Quote, adopted as part of the effort to purge the United States of the legacy of slavery, unquote, he explains, quote again, birthright citizenship, with which the 14th Amendment begins, remains an eloquent statement about the nature of American society, a powerful force for assimilation of the children of immigrants and a repudiation of a long history of racism, unquote. That all at the beginning of the 14th Amendment is remarkable in its expansiveness. All knows that there are many more to come, and it does not mind. All admits no difference between American-born citizens who can trace their ancestors to the Mayflower and those whose parents only recently landed. All proclaims that U.S. citizenship must not distinguish by race, language, wealth, education, or faith those contested markers of belonging that have caused so much strife in so many places at so many times. All is all. And that was Born in the USA Does Not Mean What It Used To by Carlos Lozada. And he wrote that for the New York Times. This is Michael McCusker. Jack Harris is today's radio engineer. My younger sister, Mary Anthonina, died this past November, her birth month, 77 years earlier. Her death was primarily from nearly a lifetime addiction of smoking cigarettes, which she several times was unable to accomplish quitting, despite great struggle, several times to break the compulsive habit. I do believe, as a former nicotine addict, that the manufacturers of cigarettes and other tobacco products, and that includes the lowliest employees as well as the tobacco barons, are guilty of more mass murder than hard drug manufacturers and peddlers, and most likely a few of the world's armies. Just before she died, Mary Nina tried to tell me how ashamed she was that she was unable to kick the habit, which I was fortunately able to do more than half a century ago, prior to the consequent addiction additives the tobacco mafia engaged in the past half century to keep their customers hooked until death. While I was in Vietnam for a year in the past millennium as a U.S. Marine, I smoked incessantly to ward off fear and burn off leeches in the jungle. Back home stateside, I came to the realization I was committing suicide and helping enrich the purveyors of my impending death, and certainly the deaths of millions, which is not an exaggeration. These titans of mass murder should be made to stand before the world court and be shamed, if not sentenced to death, for outright genocide of a vast proportion of the world's human population.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.